Christian alcoholic. Grateful to be a sober miracle of God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to all the people that introduced themselves as new, and the token takers, and the birthday people. I guess we'll have a cake on Sunday. So. My story started a little bit like this. I am a son of a lady who actually goes back a little farther. Great-grandmother crossed the border somewhere in Texas from Puebla, Mexico. Settled in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Married my grandfather, who had came from England. He was probably pretty much chased out of there, but he was a very wealthy man down in Lake Charles. He owned lots of butcher shops and different things. Probably wouldn't have let any of us in those stores back in those days because they had signs. My mother ran away back in the early days during the Depression, came to San Diego and met my father, who had left Bloomfield, New Jersey, to pedal his bicycle to be in the 33 summer games in bicycle racing. That's what he did. He arrived in Los Angeles December 2nd. 5 days later, he pedaled to San Diego and joined the Navy. Actually on ship that night, if you can imagine, at 6 o'clock. So haircut and out to sea. They never got basic until they got back. Met my mom in that little diner she worked in for tips and also worked in a laundry for 10 cents an hour. They'd hold hands to the fence at NTC, and, you know, miracle was made. And we, myself and my three sisters were born. And I mean, I had a great family life. My dad was so loving. We'd sit down. The girls would rub his feet. I'd sit in his lap, and we'd sing songs, you know, just all kinds of songs. We, you know, attended churches. My grandfather, of course, was Southern Baptist and built a lot of churches. And on weekends, he probably hung people. But the fact is, we never went to a Baptist church. We pretty much always went to whatever church was in walking distance. That's another thing they did back there. But, you know, my mom was just a Southern belle. She'd have this thing. She'd say, "I'll love you later." And everybody loved her. She was just a really nice lady. Anyway, my dad finally retired from the Navy, and we moved to the mountains up around Pine Valley. We bought this place called the Antlers Lodge. It was a bar, restaurant, campgrounds, barbershop, beauty salon, and a gas station. And my dad, you know, tended bar, and my mom cooked, my sisters waited tables, and I got up every morning at 5 o'clock and scrubbed the floors and did everything else before I went to school. That was it. And it was a good life, and I'll never forget. It was my sister's birthday, my sister Peggy, and Joey Feeney was another mountain guy I grew up with. It was their birthday, August 21st, and we had went up to a little cabin we bought up in Guatay up the road because we were closed the next day. And my mom came running in late that night, woke me up. "It's gone. It's all gone," in her little Southern accent. And the lodge had burned down. We'd had a fire, and we lost everything we owned, pretty much. The bathing suit I had on, because there was a little pool there, and we'd go swimming every day. And the bathing suit and a couple shirts, maybe a couple T-shirts, was about it. It was different, but the people in the mountains were incredible. I mean, people showed up in trucks the next day with clothing and stuff. The love was just incredible, but it was never right for my dad after that. You know, it was probably he was dealing with some sickness at that time. I never would think my father would have been an alcoholic because he was just the most determined, focused man you'd ever meet in your life. But, you know, he sat there in the bar pretty much all day and talked to his friends. And he'd get you in the bar, give you a few beers. He'd get you out to the barbershop, cut your hair, sell you some insurance, and sell you some real estate. That's what he did. But, you know, he used to take me on long drives and so forth, and he'd teach me things. And I'd be sitting there going, you know, why is he telling me this? I'm just a kid. And I know the reality is that, you know, he taught me some principles in life that has helped me, you know, at least in business and those type of things. Anyway, he died shortly thereafter, and it was me and my mom and my sister. And he was in the hospital for almost 2.5 years. My sister and I were kind of latchkey at that point. My other two sisters had pretty much gone. Like, one was living with her boyfriend, one was married. And it was Peggy and I. And my mom thought I'd be safe if I hung with her. And so every day after school, we'd come home, and I'd go somewhere with my sister. Well, my sister was a person who loved life and loved people. And unfortunately, her love for people took her to places that probably she shouldn't have been, and she definitely shouldn't have dragged her little brother. But to be in these rooms with these guys doing to my sister what they wanted to do, it was easy if they took care of me by giving me whatever they had. and it was usually a little bit of beer or wine. It was a little difficult in Guatá. I mean, you could flag down a hitchhiker and take them to a little market, and sometimes if the right person was working, you knew they couldn't see the ID. You could show them your ASB card and buy liquor. But I went to a one-room school in Descanso, and there was probably 40 kids, and Mrs. Beanie, our school teacher. My sixth grade year was the first year they decided to move the sixth graders from that one-room school in Descanso to the big school, Mountain Empire, up in Campo. About a 43-mile bus ride at that time. There was no freeways or anything, along little roads, and we had to stop. And we got to the bus stop about an hour early that day, and we waited out there, and it was freezing cold, but we wore shorts because in Campo it was very, very hot. And, we were all kind of afraid. You know, the legend was that you went to the big school in Campo, you know, the Indians and the Mexicans would just kick your ass. And so I was a little afraid. But one guy, Kerry King, showed up with a bag of pot. Another guy, Todd, showed up with a bag of glue. And a guy that later on became my brother, and I won't tell you that story, showed up with a thermos mixed with every form of liquor he could steal from his dad's bar, which eventually became my dad. I know it's weird, but after my dad died, his mom died 2 years later, and then my mom married his dad. Kind of strange, but... So we took that bus ride, and, you know, it's been incredible for me in my sobriety. I've been able to go back to the Freedom Ranch and share that I drove past this place not afraid for the first time in my life because I had all those things in my system. And, you know, that's what drugs and alcohol did for me. It took away the fear of people, the fear of not being what my father was. My father was a yeoman in the Navy. He was the yeoman for Admiral Nelson of the Pacific Fleet during World War II. And he could write. He could do everything right. And, you know, I was just a little kid that had pimples, you know. So that's where I was then. And life went on. My sister kept doing pretty much the things she did. My father eventually died, went to high school. Of course, in Campo, you know, there was close connections to the border, so there was lots of mota, we called it back then, dirt weed, actually. It was pretty bad stuff. But I found that, you know, it did the job. Alcohol was a little tough to get in the mountains, but, you know, marijuana was readily abundant, and so, you know, I learned to find that there was some peace there, and it eventually kind of became my higher power at the time. Well, graduated high school, moved to the city. And my love for pot took me to a place where I smoked pretty much every day. I got a job at one of the first Gap stores that opened up here in town. I was going to UCSD, engineering major, and I needed a little extra money. They got me a job of a company called Amtech Engineering. Back then, it was no HP 45s even. We used slide rulers, and I'd sit in a room and do calculations. Hated it. I liked people. I liked being out there. So I walked into this Gap store to buy some Levi's, and somebody came up and said, "Can you help me, young man?" And I go, "Well, I figured it out. I'm pretty smart." I looked at their rows of sizes, and anyway, I got a stack of pants and shirts for these people, and I took them up to the front counter. And I said, "I'm sure this nice young lady will check you out." And she started ringing them up. And then I went to get my stuff, and she came hunt me down in the store. And she said, "You need a job?" And she was kind of cute. So I said, "Okay." And I started working. And they weren't really involved in technology back then. There weren't computers. And I had worked in a TV repair shop in Guatay by a man that was retired Navy. And he had some contracts doing some stuff on some real large, early based computers down at the Navy base. And I was just a kid, and he'd take me. So I learned a little bit of technology. So that job went real well. And I became director of technology for a huge company and stockholder and all these things. And I was still very young. And we moved up to Los Angeles. They said, "Okay, you're going to live at your new office in Torrance." And I took one look at this, a mountain kid, and I couldn't handle this. So I found an apartment down in Huntington Beach. And, of course, I took the girl I was dating with me at the time because, you know, I couldn't face this by myself. And I would get up early every morning and my little sports car, drive the 405 and, you know, light my first reefer in the morning and make my way to Torrance. And even the traffic didn't bother me at that point. But it didn't last long. I didn't like it. I just couldn't take it. I wanted to get back to the mountains. I wanted to get back to something different. But when we moved into these apartments, there was this lock on the little storage container where my car parked. And eventually, it sat there for a long time. Eventually, I got a hacksaw or something, and I cut it off and opened it up. And there was this little toy helicopter. It was one of those little things that had batteries and a little pack. And if it worked, the helicopter would buzz around your head. And, you know, I was Mr. Fix-It, so I fixed it up and got it working. And me and a friend were sitting around smoking some fairly good stuff at that point. We'd graduated. And it was buzzing around our head, and we're going, wow, man, this is really cool. And somewhere along the line, one of us, I don't even remember who, stuck the joint in the top of the little thing, and it sucked the smoke down and shot it out the switch hole. Well, of course we had to do this, and I went to every store, toy store you can imagine in Los Angeles, and bought every one I could, and broke off the things, put a bowl on it, and started giving them away for Christmas time to my friends. And of course, you know, my dad taught me right about business. So I was able to make some contacts up in Sausalito with a company called AMAC Plastics. I was making injection molding. I imported all the motors and switches from Taiwan. And by the time I was 21, we had manufactured about 384,000 of them. We call them the original Willy's Buzzmaster. It was the first handheld battery-operated, completely portable shotgun pipe. Loaded, lighted, shoots out a steady stream of smoke, a foot long with some special buttons. And in the early days, we would take them, and we'd go to Balboa Park or any place, and we'd load them with some pretty good stuff, and we'd walk up to people. We didn't even know them. We'd shoot them in the face, and we'd sell them for $20. And that was loaded, but, you know, we pretty much knew how to get pot wholesale. So that was that, and we ended up making a lot of money. I think all in all, like $15, $20 million went through our hands along the way. And we got to the end of the product life. They started breaking, and with that, we can't continue to make these. I met a guy through the industry called Dick Knight. He owned a company called LAPD, Los Angeles Pipe Distributors. And he had 14 of these little step vans that went throughout Los Angeles, greater Los Angeles area, and distributed bongs and paraphernalia to all these people in these stores. And I took the rest of the product we had. We had 5,000 or 10,000 of them left. I took the rest of them and traded them for a bunch of other bongs and pipes, and I opened up some stores. First one was in Lakeside. It was called Stone Willie's. Some of you old enough probably bought some stuff there. The bikers would come in and buy their cut in their little bags to put their back then it wasn't crystal like today. It was peanut butter crank, pretty much battery acid. And I'm grateful I never found a love for that. Meanwhile, all these people were drinking around me, and you know, beer and booze, that was like, you know, why would I want to ruin this beautiful buzz I have by having a hangover the next day? I never had a concept of what alcohol could do or what it was. A few beers, never really got into, you know, any major alcohol or any mixed drinks or anything. Well, I had employees that worked for me, and of course, you know, they took a few things home because they were pretty much all drug addicts. And we would sit there all day long and play backgammon and smoke dope. And my pastor from my church had heard that I knew a little bit about computers, and at this point I had built a couple of computers in the early days, and I designed a little point-of-sale program that ran off of my wife's little cassette deck, and it printed out a little receipt and everything else, and there were no little computers like that in those days. And he I guess said something to the church council, and next thing I know, I was at church on Sunday, and Judge Overton, I'll never forget this, a federal bench judge, came up to me and said, "Christian, we'd like you to stay after church and meet with us." So I stayed after church, and I'm sitting in this room, and Judge Overton's here, and these other gentlemen, all upstanding members of the San Diego community at College Lutheran Church, okay? And he says, "Christian, we'd like you to teach Sunday school to the high school kids." And Pastor, meantime, had been coming out to the store, and we were doing the mailing labels for the church, because the ladies were handwriting them for years. And I looked over at Pastor, and I looked back at Judge, and I said, "You know, Judge, I don't know that you know what I do for a living." And he goes, "Christian, we know exactly what you do, but that we know these kids are all smoking pot today." And back then, the kids smoked pot, the adults drank, and it was accepted. There was this College Lutheran Church. Everybody had a motorhome. Everybody went to the Aztec games, to the football games, and they drank. That's what they did. There weren't the 502 enforcement like there was today. And so I said something like, I'll pray about it. Actually, I think I'll go get wasted and think about it. But I went back to my store and that next Monday, and I sat there, and I had just smoked a joint, and I was waiting for a friend to come in to play some backgammon. And I was looking around, and I just said, "I can't do this anymore. My wife was pregnant with my first daughter, and I can't do this anymore." I called my landlords. I got out of my leases for all my stores. I called a guy that owned a company called the Synthetic Trips, and I sold all the rest of my bongs and pipes and everything to him, and I got out of the industry. I got really involved in that church. That means I got a motorhome, and I went to those games. And, you know, I became an Aztec fan, and everything was good. And most of the time then, a little bit of beer. I actually stayed pretty clean and sober for some time. And my computer business grew. Life was what I thought pretty good. And one evening, a friend of mine called me. He was ex-narcotics task force, kind of strange. We became really good friends. He got out of the industry and was a real estate agent. And we used to chat because, you know, they used to try to set us up at the stores back in the day and so forth. And he was actually a sheriff one day before he became a narcotics agent. He was on patrol out there at the park out in Lakeside. And me and a friend were driving his Corvette, and we were out to, you know, burn a bowl. And we got pulled over and by him, actually. And he walked up the car, looked at me, turned back to look at his partner and says, "Hey, Henry, we got old Stone Willie here." And I should have known at that point. So we got to be friends, and I went over there and was working on his computer. And he looked at me and he said, "Hey, how would you like a shot?" And, you know, it didn't really occur to me what he meant. I go, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "You know, some whiskey." I said, "Sure, you know, I'll try a little bit." So he took a regular styrofoam coffee cup, and he poured me a glass of some Jim Beam. I took one drink, I looked at him, and I said, "Is this legal?" And and I knew I was home again. It was, you know, this warm feeling. It felt good. I felt confident. I felt different than I felt. I felt even different than what I felt when I was doing illegal substances. But I knew it would become part of my life. And I went home that night. I didn't really say anything to my wife, but I went to sleep. I slept well. I got up. I didn't really feel bad the next day. And so, you know, about 3 days later, I called him up and said, "Hey, any more problems with your computer?" And pretty soon, after a little bit, I stopped in there every day. After a little bit longer, I started buying. After a little bit longer, I met the, originally it was Liquor Bar, and then it became Beverages and More, the manager. And, of course, I always had powders and herbal material at that point because that went along with the drinking. And I traded a little bit, and he would buy pallets and store them for me at the La Mesa Beverages and More. And I'd go by in one of my trucks and pick up 3 or 4 bottles every other day. And towards the end of my drinking, basically, it came down to 2 bottles of what became 10 high whiskey every single day for about 27 years. And you would have never known. I could have looked you right in the eye. You could have been around me. You could have been there when I was working. You could have been one of my customers. You would have thought that I was very focused on what I did. You thought I would be perfectly okay. I built a tolerance to this stuff that just went on and let me do what I needed to do. I was a very functional alcoholic, but I was also dying. I was 384 pounds when everything came to an end. You know, like everybody's story, every organ in my body was dying. And I, of course, thought I was perfectly okay. My concept was that I never abused drugs and alcohol. I utilized them. I utilized them to make me a better, a better everything. You know, I for a while we had a company called the Real Estate Computer Company. I would travel with this guy who put on seminars at the Superdome, and he'd get these guys fired up on selling real estate, and he'd turn them over to me, and I'd sell them computers they didn't need. But I spoke in front of a bunch of people, and it always started with, you know, what I needed to lubricate myself to do what I did. And that went on for some time. My rule was I didn't drink around you. I didn't drink around my family because I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. The way I wanted to drink was my thirsty 2-ouncer filled 9/10 of the way to the top with 10 high whiskey and 1/4 inch of Diet 7-Up on top. And why it was Diet 7-Up, I don't know. There's so much sugar there. I was so diabetic. My sister had just died with dual pancreas pumps from diabetes. My father actually died of cancer, was diabetic, borderline at least all of his life. My grandfather died from the disease. And when my sister died from, you know, a combination of the family disease, diabetes, and the disease of drugs more than alcohol, she liked to smoke her pot, and then she would chase her pot with 3 or 4 Mars bars, and of course, didn't go well with her pancreas pumps. That was not enough. That didn't faze me. I thought everything was great. Life was going good. I sold my computer business and opened up some other things that allowed me more time. I bought a big step van, put a Costco-type photo system in there, and went around to pictures of over-the-line tournaments and golf tournaments. It was called Photo to You. And this was cool because there we could drink openly, and the disease just continued to grow. But I still never drank at home. I never drank around my wife. My concept was drinking while I drove, while I was parked out in front of your business, when I left your business, and all day long pretty much in my office with my employees. That's what I did. And I was getting bad, but you know, I really thought that it was there. I was very active in church. I thought I had a faith, but you know, God may have had me, but I had no concept of what He was in my life or what He would become in my life. One night, I was sitting around. What I normally did is I quit drinking around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd pull over in one of my company vans somewhere, and I'd pass out for a couple hours. Then I'd go home and sit in my easy chair and smile and try to be a good husband, a good father. One night, I'm sitting there. I got that feeling, just like people do. Wouldn't a highball be nice right around now? And I went out to my van. I grabbed a thirsty 2-ouncer. I filled it up. I put my little bit of 7-Up. I came in. I was watching something like Howard Stern or something I shouldn't have been watching in the first place. And just enjoying my bourbon. I broke my rule. And all of a sudden, I heard this stirring behind me, some noise. Turned around. It was my wife. She goes, "What are you doing? What are you watching? What are you watching this crap? What are you doing? What are you drinking? Are you drinking alcohol? Since when do you drink alcohol? This has got to stop right now." And she goes, "Where's it at?" And, you know, at the time, I had gone all the way out to my van. That's probably what woke her up. And there was other stuff hidden around the house. I didn't think about that. So I led her to a little bottle in the garage, and she dumped it out. And she goes, "Let's go to bed." So I went to bed, got up the next morning, and, you know, I was feeling like, okay, I'm ready to go. It was a Sunday that next morning. And my MO was I got up, I went to church, I turned on all the computers, I did my job, then I went out to the parking lot and drank for a couple hours. And then I came back in, and, of course, I was either a greeter or a... an usher, or sometimes I even, you know, was a person that shared the body and blood. And that's the way it was. Well, that next Sunday, I got up, and she was up, very rare. She goes, "I'm going with you." And I said, "Oh, well, honey, you know, I got all this stuff to do at the church. You're going to be bored. You can't do this." She goes, "I'm going with you." I said, "Okay, let's go." So we went to church, and at this point, I'm sitting there back running a little computer, much like that gentleman over there is, and I had not had my, you know, my morning drink. And I'm starting to feel it, a little shaky, a little weird. I just felt really, really bad. And so we got out of church, and I made up a lie. I said, "Oh, hey, one of my clients called. He's having a problem. I got to go up there today." And she looks at me and goes, "Let's go." Oh, honey, no. You can't. You know, this. You know, you'd be bored. You can't do this. So I went home. I made up another lie. I said, "Oh, you know, he called back. Everything's okay. We'll deal with it on Monday." So I got home really, really restless, irritable, and discontent. I went upstairs, did something, I don't remember, but I started feeling really, really bad. Well, the next day, of course, was Monday, and I got up around 4 o'clock, ready to go to work, and I went in, I didn't shower, I just grabbed my stuff, and I tiptoed down, and I got down to where my keys are normally hanging on the hook, and I looked, and they weren't there. And I'm looking around furiously, and I hear this jingle jangle behind me, and she said, "Looking for these?" And I said, "Yeah, what are you doing with keys?" And she goes, "I'm going with you." My wife, 30 X amount of years of business at that point, my wife never went to our office unless she had a friend in town and she wanted to, you know, show them what her husband did for a living. Otherwise, she never came to any of my businesses. And I got pissed off. I go, "Honey, you know it's not going to work. I do all this stuff during the day. You can't do that." So I don't remember. I did something. I got mad. I yelled. I probably called her a few names. I went upstairs and I laid down. And that was kind of the last thing I remember. This would be basically 3 days, probably X amount of hours, maybe 78 hours or so since I'd had a drink. Next thing I knew, I saw my pastor, my wife, my son-in-law, my future son-in-law at that point, my daughter. They're all around me. And my wife saying, "What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?" They found me. I was naked on the floor. I had, you know, there was vomit, blood, urine, all this stuff. And I don't remember any of this. And all these people were around me. Next thing I know, you know, they took me one place, then to a hospital. And I'm in a bed. and my wife and my doctor in the edge of the bed, and I still didn't really know what's going on. Well, it turns out, and this is very important to my story, that I had a neuro seizure from withdrawals of alcohol. You know, heroin will make you really sick. Alcohol kills more people than anything else out there, period. And the withdrawals from alcohol, when you drink the kind of alcohol that I did, is just an incredible thing. Next thing I knew, laying there, I didn't want to be there. I somehow made up an excuse or something to the nurse that I was going to the bathroom. I grabbed something. I ended up showing up at a golf tournament. I just opened a disc golf tournament, another one of these little businesses I could do for drinking. And I opened up a disc golf course in La Mesa that I designed and everything while I was drinking. And I showed up there for the first golf tournament, and I'm in a hospital gown. Well, the police showed up, my wife, daughter showed up, and they said, okay, Christian, you can stay for the tournament if you agree to go to treatment. And I don't know what I said or what I did, but the next thing I knew, I ended up in Rancho La Brea up in Del Zura. And there was just no way I wanted to stay there. I was on a walker or a wheelchair. I really didn't speak. I really couldn't do much of anything. But still, three or four times they caught me halfway down that dirt road, B Road or whatever it is up there, trying to get the heck out of the place, and they'd bring me back. And every time they did, my counselor would say, Christian, you need to read page 407 and write me a one-page report. Because I could not accept that situation I was in. I wanted to be the hell out of there. I wanted life to be back to what it was. And I had no concept of what had actually happened to me or where my brain was at. I was so delusional. I tackled this guy named Tree. He was one of the counselors there. They call him Tree. He was like 6'9" or something. I tackled him. I was just sure as can be one night that I got out of there. I went home. I got into my safe. I grabbed some money. I rented a car, I think, along the way. I mean, it was so intense, but I'd put the money underneath my mattress in this facility, and I woke up the next morning, it wasn't there, and I thought he stole it. And I was ready to kick this guy's butt, and bottom line is, I couldn't walk. I was on a walker, and I couldn't stand up for more than 3 feet. But those were the type of delusional things that happened. From there, my wife would take me to meetings. Life got bad. I lived in this world of depression, knowing that I did this to what I thought was a promising career. I didn't talk pretty much for almost a little under 2 years, maybe 5 or 10 words. I don't know if too many of you remember. I know there's a few here that knew me back in the day, but I lost everything. I lost my ability to do my work. I couldn't even turn on a computer. I couldn't do any of it. And I had this, you know, the book describes that bitter morass, this feeling of that I did this to myself. I read something in the book about this wet brain, and I go, oh my God, I got a friggin' wet brain, and I'm never going to be this person again. And it was bad, and this depression put me in a place where I didn't want anything that any of you had, but my wife kept taking me to meetings. Well, eventually I got well enough to be able to drive, and I drove myself to a little meeting down in El Cajon on Melody Lane. And I'd go in the meeting every day. I'd get a cup of coffee to take home to my wife. I didn't drink coffee. I'd take it to her because that way she knew I actually went to the meeting. I'd get a donut, and there weren't donuts every day, but Tuesdays. There was this guy from Ramona. I used to just wait in the parking lot for him to pull up. And oh, a donut, because, you know, we had no money at that point. We didn't lose our house or everything, but we were down to, you know, taking things out of our neighbor's trash. It cost a lot of money for treatment. I had all this money from selling my businesses, and I went through a lot of money through this whole process. But I would go to the meeting, I'd get my donut, cup of coffee, I'd come back out and listen to Dave Shelley and Chainsaw on the radio. And that's what I'd do. I'd sit outside. And one day I just came in, got coffee, got the donut, I was heading back out, and I was about halfway out to my vehicle, and a gentleman setting up at the main table, was the secretary, got up from the meeting, followed me out, and looked right me in the eye and said, hey, what's up with you? You come in here, you drink our coffee, you take our donuts, yet you're not willing to do anything to change your life. You're never going to get your life back unless you realize that these people here that love you are willing to help you. You need to set your butt down there and listen. And I got to tell you, I was just shocked. I didn't know what was happening. I was embarrassed, but I went back in and I sat and listened. And, you know, life started getting better little by little. Meanwhile, back at that church, this lady in Maryland who was the choir director, she kept asking me, "Hey, Christian, we got a problem with the DVD and the church computer." And this is in the sanctuary. It was the computer that ran what's called Media Shot, which is like you see this presentation up on the screen. And she goes, "Can you fix it?" And I, "Oh, Marilyn, I can't do that anymore. You know, I just can't. I was just starting to understand a little bit about this book and how this program worked. But I had no confidence whatsoever I could do it. And I couldn't remember anything at all dealing with the computers." But she kept asking me, and one Sunday she asked me in front of my wife. And my wife said, "You get your butt down there tomorrow and you try." And I went down to this church, and I'm sitting in the sanctuary all by myself. I walked in. There's two lights there. The first light turned on the little lights up on the altar around, and the cross which lit up, and the sun coming through the stained glass windows. And that was it. All by myself. We're talking two screws, one wire, piece of cake, right? It took me 2 hours. And I finally got it done, and I sit down at the computer, and I felt good. I go, "Wow, I did it. And this is a good thing." I looked at that desktop in the computer, and there's a little folder there that said website. And it was actually a website that I had designed for the church a couple years previous. And I opened that folder up, and why, I clicked on this one particular file, but in that file was a little JavaScript that I'd spent a lot of time writing. And I looked at it, and I did not recognize a word. It was just Greek. And all of a sudden, it hit me, and I just got really pissed off. I kicked a little hole in the wall. I looked up to that cross, and I said, "F you, God. Kill me or give me my effing brain back." I fell on the ground. I cried. I don't know how long went by. I don't know what happened. But it all of a sudden popped into my head that, you know, my wife was going to leave me alone for the first time. We're not really alone. She was going to have my sister come over and check on me. But about 2.5 years at that point, she was going to leave me to go to a wedding back in Iowa. There was going to be alcohol there. She didn't think I should go. And I would not have done it. She was my caretaker. She wiped my butt. You know, she fed me. She did everything. But all of a sudden, this plan came into my head that, you know, when she's gone, I'll go ahead and go buy that same 2 bottles of 10 High whiskey, and I'll drink it. You know, like a lot of us, the doctors say, you know, you drink again and you're dead. And I thought, hey, this is a solution. And I remember getting up off that floor, wiping the tears from my eyes, setting back down to that computer, actually feeling good. For the first time in a long time, I felt good that I knew, like our chapter in the book, there was a solution. Of course, it wasn't the right solution. My solution was, you know, a way out through suicide. I sat back down at that computer. I looked back up at that same folder that was open there on the screen. And I knew every single line of code. I knew exactly what it meant. I knew exactly what it did. I started typing. I rewrote the website. I went in to the pastor was in his office, and I went in and I said, "Hey, maybe you want to look at this." And he like dropped, because, you know, I was Christian, the guy that hung out there at church, that never talked to anybody, that never said a word, that basically had a wet brain, that killed himself through, you know, through his desire to use drugs and alcohol. And my life changed that day. I went back to that meeting that next day. I found myself a sponsor. They gave me, actually, this book here at Rancho Brie when I got there. And I actually started reading it. I started slowly but surely understanding what the book actually says instead of what my brain wanted it to say. That sponsor showed me where the little places in the first 164 pages that break into the different steps. I thought the steps were where you read them and how they work. And I couldn't figure out what you were supposed to do except do these things. My life changed. I became very proactive. I got back into my business. I didn't lose the house. Life got really, really good. This program has just been so incredible in my life. So many people. Thousands of friends. And I tell people all the time that, you know, I've got thousands of friends in this thing. And a lot of people might think that's an exaggeration, but you all know, you people here. The people that love me until I learned to love myself. And through this program, I've developed a level of gratitude. And, you know, today I get up every day and I say, "Which way, Haas?" I believe 100% that if I make a left turn when I meant to turn right, God needs me to turn left. there's somebody, something that needs me to be of service in that direction. And, you know, I just accept it. I try to be of service as much as I can. I really believe in getting one of these and trying to wear it out. They give you a new one just about any meeting you go to for free. Thank you. I announce myself as a miracle of God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because I really believe I am. Yet as intense as my story is and as much as a miracle as I think it is, it's nothing. I see miracles every single day out there. And the way this thing works is real simple. God sends me that miracle to see just when I need to see it. You know, I share all the time also that every day I get up and ask for my daily bread. And every afternoon he backs the hostess truck right up to my doorstep. That's my life today. I've got friends that love me. I don't have to be when I'm not. I don't have to lie. I've got friends that, are part of this. There's just one thing, because I normally always start my shares with something from the big book, and I didn't really go there tonight, but it says at the beginning of There's a Solution, it talks about comparing us to the passengers on a shipwrecked vehicle, and I think you guys probably have all read that, but the feeling of having shared a common peril is one of the elements in the powerful concrete, or cement, it says, which binds us. But that in itself would not have held us together as we now are joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us toward a common solution, we have a way out which we can absolutely agree upon, which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. That's it. This fellowship restored me to sanity. This fellowship gave me a life that's unbelievable. If you want to, after the meeting, I'll come up and show you the picture of my grandson on my phone. I have a relationship with my daughter that was just non-existent when I was drinking. You know, she knew her daddy as the person that took her to every park in San Diego County. But she played on the play equipment while I sat in the car and drank. I have a wife that just basically, you know, I pacified. I controlled her. I regulated everything in our house. We have a relationship today. It's still a work in progress. I think all relationships with Normans will always be a work in progress. But God has given me the ability to understand what it says in acceptance, this concept of emotional independence. You know, you could come up to me right now and say just about anything. I'd probably smile and tell you I love you. Because reality is there's only one thing in this world that really affects my life. And that's my relationship with my higher power and how it is today. I'd like you to like me, but it's not going to make me have a bad day. And it sure as heck is not going to make me pick up a drink. And I'll just close with this. I've not been around a lot as long as a lot of the people that speak here or even a lot of my friends out there in here that, you know, I have an incredible amount of respect for. I'd sit in the rooms even after I had quite a bit of sobriety and my leg would be thumping. I'd be still a little nervous. And I'd look over at one of these guys and they'd be sitting there going, "Yep, it's a good day." And, you know, I wanted that so badly. And I started basically imitating what they did. And, you know, I feel my life's that way today. I was at a speaker's meeting at the convention a couple years ago up in Anaheim. And there was this lady of about 36 years that got up and shared. And it was an incredible testimony to not only her relationship with her higher power, but with her walk in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and how her life changed. And she ended with this. She said, "I'm one of God's favorite children, and you can be one too." And I'll tell you, that spoke to me, and I never forget that. When I was in that wheelchair at Rancho La Brea, a man who was a doctor, actually had a daughter in the program there. He was a doctor from Imperial Valley. He walked up and handed me a piece of paper. And all it said was, "Never forget what it was like." And, you know, I still have that piece of paper. I keep it in one of my books at home. I read it whenever I need to. This program's taught me to know when I need a meeting. It's taught me to know when I need to go to a book study or read the steps. It's taught me to listen, something I never could do before. It's taught me to also talk when I need to. It's given me a sense of life that makes me feel like I'm finally the man my mommy would have wanted me to be. Not that way in my life. And through all of that, it's gratitude. I'm grateful for each and every one of you in my life. I'm grateful for all the people out there that came to support me tonight. And I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.